Excited about this panel because I work a lot in the DAM space and all the related tools. And we have a bunch of DAM smarties up here. Never get tired of the DAM jokes. I'm going to have each of the panelists introduce themselves and give a little bit of context on some of the cool things you're working on.
Hi, I'm Corinne Whitney. I'm from Crawford Media Services. We have a tool called Metaforce. It's a cloud-based platform for metadata tagging, and we recruit and train people specifically toward your collections, whatever those may be, in order to do that tagging. So we are not crowdsourced, but rather we utilize professionals who work on the cloud, on our tool, under an NDA, and we work on both managing those people as well as making sure that the metadata is working in your DAM system, whatever it may be. So right now we work on a little collection known as the MTV Vault. It goes back a little while. Our Viacom friends are here, and we've been working with them for some time to really try to put a finer point on making sure that that domestic content is getting tagged in a way that's most useful for them and most accessible to the taggers who work around the country.
And we talked a lot today about the human element, which we're going to dig into deeper, and with how that affects content.
Matt Corodemus, I head up media and entertainment for Nuxio. Nuxio is a hyperscale DAM, cloud-born, built by engineers and architects for engineers and architects at the end of the day. So it's open source. I invite all of you to go download it immediately.
Hello, I'm Callum Hughes. I'm the Global Solutions Architect for Amazon Studios. I'm helping Amazon Studios build a whole bunch of infrastructure. As you'd imagine, everything is cloud-based at Amazon.
Hi, I'm Kyle Hufford, Director of Digital Asset Management at Monster Energy. I'm working on building and implementing a global infrastructure for our teams to manage one central location of an image library and connect all of our systems to it.
So the session is about the smart supply chain. And you have so many elements in that. You have data, you have technology, and with that technology, you have the BAM, the DAM, the PAM, whatever you're calling it, whatever flavor, or several of those within an organization. So when you're dealing with data sets, we'll start there. When you're dealing with data, what reigns supreme? You have all these different data sets coming in to your supply chain.
Who wants to field it first?
I think it's based on what folks are searching. It's really based on what are your users needing. I mean, that's the first question. It has to be the middle question. It has to be the last question, because otherwise you're missing the mark on the metadata.
What reigns supreme is line of business. What does the line of business need to do their job? And that's at the end of the day. I think where, you know, this is Smart Content Summit, we're talking about metadata all day. Everybody struggles with, you know, the silos we discussed earlier. They struggle with rationalizing the metadata across business units, across systems, across applications. And that creates kind of the frenzy of we're always behind because structurally nothing's very well aligned and everybody's digging that out at their own pace. Because that situation exists, you have to just admit that line of business metadata seems to be what rules.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the way we look at it. I mean, one of the big things for Amazon is we typically will always repeat the mantra, start with your customer and then work backwards. And that's certainly true of the infrastructure we've been building at Amazon Studios. And it's defining like who are our customers and what are the kind of workflows they want us to help them with. And then you define from there. So you kind of start from your customer, then work backwards, and that's really what governs, like what is king, is what your customer essentially tells you is king.
And even working in an organization, there could be many silos, so you have many different data sets going into a system. So how is that being managed? Where do you start?
I think the age old, you know, saying is, how do you eat an elephant? And it's always one bite at a time. So for us, it's a challenge of, you know, I could have taken the approach of, I'm going to spend 2 years developing something and try to implement it after the workflows have expired and moved on and gone to wherever it was. Or I can take a small approach and take some small 3 month, 6 month projects and start to build upon them. So in our situation, it worked really well. And building on those successes, I mean, day one, I had on average 6 users in the system a year and a half ago. I have on average 85 users that log in and interact with the system now a year and a half later. And it's only growing. This is just the beginning of our journey.
Yeah, absolutely. And a key thing you said there was the successes. One of the things, you know, I've certainly found since I moved to Amazon Studios is proof is of the pudding is in the tasting, right? So finding those kind of wins for your DAM infrastructure is really important. You can't boil an ocean. And you can't eat an elephant in one sitting, right? So you've really got to figure out, and a lot of planning has to go into, how do you start your DAM project, the DAM thing? You have to kind of really sit back and be like, okay, like what is important and is going to be something realistically achievable in enough time for me to say, look, this stuff actually works. So now we're going to build out the platform. And that's kind of how we approached it.
But then there's this consistent problem where the business wants to move faster than rationalizing this data, or eating the elephant one bite at a time. I think the business would like you to have a bigger mouth a lot of times. And that's one of the big problems is the business has raced ahead. By the time you solve their problem, they've got 10 other problems. So when you're looking at it at the highest level, I think it's, you know, it comes down to monetizing IP, you know, at the top level. If we're going to monetize that IP, and we know that individual business systems reign supreme in terms of the metadata, we talked earlier about carrots and sticks and getting people to put the right stuff in, I think you just have to get to the point where we admit that master data management hasn't quite worked out yet, and we need to think of the right data model that can middle things for these large organizations that need to monetize that IP.
I think a lot of organizations are also realizing that they can kind of fold in their data sets and take down their silos and fold everything in, and there's much more of an acknowledgement now than there used to be that metadata is always evolving and expanding and linking and creating those relationships amongst itself and throughout all the business units. So that's becoming much more widely known.
Good point, too. And earlier today, Amber showed us the image with the snake and eating its tail, and how, much to your point, how new metadata or data is coming in, giving end users or your customers better experiences. Let's talk about some automation tools as your content moves through the supply chain. And Kyle, I know you're working on some interesting things with automating things. And this is a question to all of you, is what can be automated and what cannot be automated?
So I want to echo what Amber had mentioned earlier. I mean, the key thing here is don't try to automate something that humans can do better. I mean, really the key thing that Crawford offers, and we've utilized some other services, or from my perspective, are like the manual tagging and cataloging of somebody who's a librarian is something that you can't replace with a machine. You can't do it. Curating of that content and actually tagging it correctly the first time, rather than having a machine go through and do it, and then you have to check it once, twice, three, four times, it's not the same. And so from our perspective, I'm looking at things like automating product metadata, automating our bill of materials through SAP, through connecting product images and product data. So from our perspective, looking at those type of things and then connecting systems like our front-end web tools to the DAM to create control points. Marketing never used to have a control point. People would just publish whatever they wanted to publish on there. So from our perspective, as seeing this come together in a central library, and you know, I probably have the simplest of every DAM in here, and everybody's like, oh my gosh, I'm jealous, you can move so quick. But part of it is, we still have the same business challenges that everybody else does. How do I onboard more people quickly? And some of the automations are, we have a external We have external media that accesses our content to publish on websites, magazines, et cetera. We don't do a lot of traditional advertising. So I have a tool. Media can go there. They can register. It goes to the regional communication manager. If they approve it, it provisions the user. Every user that gets provisioned within the system automatically saves me probably a half an hour of man labor. And in the last month, I've had over 200 registered users, completely automated, hands off, 100% taken care of. And those are things that automation helps.
Callum, are you doing anything interesting over at Amazon that you can share?
In terms of automation, I mean, we're always looking for ways we can obviously economize, our workflows and things like that. And there is some stuff within our DAM that, so the DAM for us is essentially just the base platform, right? Like it's the kind of the building block, if you want, for our entire kind of infrastructure. And there are sort of tentacles of the DAM, to make it even creepier, which reach out into different parts of the post-production and production work world that we have. So we've looked at things like, automated QC stuff, but you can't really do that, I don't think, right now. So that's like an area that we know that there are people who do it, but right now we don't do that. But we're automating things like moving our assets around. So we'll automatically have, assets being, thrown around the different areas that need these assets. And that's all done automatically because we feel comfortable with moving assets. So in terms of not automating stuff, it's more of the QC side of things for us right now. But we're always looking for areas that we can automate additional stuff.
And this is for all of you. What kind of innovations are you seeing or where you'd like to be towards the end of the year with automating, moving content around quickly and easily, getting it to its distribution point?
Yeah, I think, if automation is our end goal, then it's having that whole supply chain is automated, right? Mm-hmm. Like the asset gets delivered, it automatically gets pushed to the next people who need it, then it's automatically, it has everything transcoded or whatever needs to happen on it, and then it's automatically encrypted and pushed out to the delivery side, and so having that fully automated would be cool. We're not there yet. We're getting closer and closer to that. But again, that comes back to the point about you have to prove it. You have to prove that it actually works, and that's a big thing for automation. Because it's easy to say this is simple to do. You just write a workflow, but you still need to prove that it actually does work.
Actually, that's a really good point. Because you have the human factor in that and the change management factor in that, and that's really scary for people.
Yeah, letting go of the steering wheel, right? When we all get our self-driving cars, the first time you do it, you're going to be like, oh my God. So seeing how that plays out is a good way to think about it. Letting go of the control is what you need to build the trust up and the comfort level. So that's trial and error and seeing how it goes.
From an innovation standpoint, I'm actually going to go the other way on that. There's just a massive amount of technology debt in every company that we're experiencing. There are humans still carrying hard drives. I mean, we're talking about tagging AI. We're talking about neural nets and their implications of how we're going to create content, possibly. But the reality is a lot of people in this room, a lot of the smartest content and technology people in the world are here. There's technology debt that just has to be taken care of before you really get to fly. The cloud's changed everything. Everybody's moving. Everybody got over their inhibitions. Everything's being reinvented. There's projects at every single one of your shops right now taking care of that technology debt. And so I don't know that the innovations are going to be cool, that will drag things through. But really solving that debt is, that's what I'll be working on probably through this year.
Good. Yeah.
Good. I don't know if I have any big automation challenges this year. I think my big goal is to never see a 4 terabyte hard drive sitting on a shelf and nobody knowing that that content is backed up. I don't know if that's ever going to go away, but if I can at least reduce that, that content from being out there with nobody knowing that it's there and actually put it somewhere where somebody can see it or use it, I think that we're on the right path.
That's a good point. Actually, I have to pick on you for a second, Kyle, because it sparked something. that has to do with automation. I heard you give a presentation about a year ago, and we were talking about emailing. And you said that all of your users, none of them should ever email an image to another person. So essentially you're taking an image out of your digital asset management system or whatever system you have, and you're emailing it to someone in your marketing division or someone who's working on web apps, whatever it, that is. Do you want to give a little bit of context and and how that's still working out for you? I'm assuming
well,
it is. It,
from my perspective, we have all of these tools in our wheelhouse, and a lot of people don't know what they don't know. It's the concept of how we learn things. And so everybody says, oh, I have email. That's a business tool. Well, email is a business tool that has become a leash, in my opinion. It doesn't really enable people to get things done. It's a tool that we all have, and some people dread it, and some people like subscribe to things like, oh, I'm going to turn my email off except for 30 minutes in the morning and 30 minutes at lunch. And, you know, all of these people have different ways of managing their email or their help desk inbox, depending on what your roles or situations are. And my opinion was like, hey, if you've got a 20 megabyte PSD file, why are you sending it over email? We have it in a system. You click a button, a link sends, it's 1K. So from my perspective, from an efficiency standpoint, why are you doing that? And from my perspective, we're doing that with training. So have we seen a reduction? Absolutely. Are there still cases that people email images? Absolutely. I'm not going to get rid of everything. But we've reduced it. We've reduced the footprint. We've reduced our Exchange server size, except for the fact now that we don't delete anything, but that's a whole nother challenge. But I mean, it's how you educate the users. They don't know what they don't know. So if you just leave a user and say, you give a graphic designer, here, you're doing this, and they're like, oh, well, I need to send this out to the printer, but you have no mechanism that you provided them. They're going to go to WeTransfer. They're going to go to Dropbox. They're going to go to Box or all of these other cloud services that none of us in a corporate world want them to use because none of that's controlled. So now I have my IP just sitting out there on the public internet. So I think that's the challenge is understanding what the business needs and then educating people that it's there because most people don't even know. I had a user come to me. They're like, hey, what happened? How come I cannot get on Box? Well, I'm shutting Box down. So we have OneDrive that's a part of our corporate infrastructure, and this is how you get access to it. Like, they didn't know. So without that education, that's a big challenge from the user standpoint is how do we, and this is a challenge that I have, how do we roll that out? Is that a part of HR onboarding? Is that really where it belongs? Is it a part of user adoption? Because there are so many really killer tools like Box and Dropbox and OneDrive that are on the consumer side that are consumerized, and us in the corporate world are like, whoa, I don't want to touch that because there's no security controls. I mean, talk about a nightmare. Put your, you know, recipes on Dropbox. Everybody can get to it. I mean, that's a major, like, security hole.
Yeah. And along with user training, you also have to make a marvelous user experience with all of your tools. So what makes for a great user experience? All of you.
Speed.
Faster. Well, faster, anybody we have
can
the technology.
Anybody can paint screens in a pretty way.
It's got to be something that a user uses, right? The problem is, and what Kyle has kind of touched on there is, if you make a system that your users hate, they will find a workaround, right? So they will go back to Box, or they'll try to go back to Box, or try to go to Dropbox, or whatever they're comfortable with. So that's what makes a really good user experience. And again, that comes back to, and I sound like a broken record. Start with your customer, work backwards. Right. Find out what is it. Like, what is it they need to do? What do they want? What do they want to use? What do they like using? And then design your infrastructure around those use cases. And then they won't, you know, break out.
There's somebody in this room that told me, I know my users, my thousands of users, they're only using 12 buttons. I want to know which 12.
And if you think of user experience and building systems and working from, you know, your customers, or the end user experience backwards. Corinne, what's the biggest part of that you're seeing with your clients with the concern with data and moving backwards? I know you touched a little bit about it, but.
Yep. Well, for us, you know, one of the things that we're trying to help do is make sure that the right kind of metadata is being captured in order to look for the right kind of monetization schemes. So is it that, you know, they're collecting a certain amount of information right now so that something is archived or monetized or both? Is that monetization approach determined yet? Or is it in some kind of a future state, and how can we help them get there? So that's a big part of it, is that brainstorming and making sure that all of the what ifs, we're all here because we ask what if. That's what everyone in this room does every day. And that stands for us with our clients as well, as we say, you know, I mean, I have a pretty good day when a cataloger, much like in Kyle's situation, says, hey, guess what? There's this thing, and wouldn't it be cool if? I mean, when we can get that kind of collaboration from catalogers that we can then share with our client to think about the future state of their monetization, that's a pretty good day.
And for delivery platforms, we're going down the supply chain here, kind of out of order, but that's okay. Delivery platforms, you're making this user experience great so they can get the things out there. What kind of tools, delivery tools, are you guys working with or see?
So that's really dealer's choice on the client side, but I mean, everybody's kind of going with the distribution portals, you know, the standard file transfer UDP processes. But what I think is more interesting is, because if we're talking about production, I mean,
right.
It's that, but what's more interesting is what's happening in marketing in general. So, you know, there's a lot of social channel outputs, a lot of channel marketing going on. So when you're looking at it from that perspective, it goes back to the automation question. So where are you reaching people? How are you closing the loop on the analytics from what you're distributing? So you're, if your outpoint's at a Sprinklr, for instance, how are you tying that back to maybe creation, which assets are working? How quickly are you getting data? I mean, nobody wants a failure of a launch. No one wants to have the wrong content for the, you know, out in the marketing space. So, you know, distribution takes on, you know, other than the mechanics, it takes on a really big, we've got multiple channels that this is going out on. Is it being effective on those channels? And sometimes people just don't know. And not knowing is a very bad thing.
Yeah, as we were kind of discussing.
For us, distribution is self-service. I mean, that's really a key component. So if I think about product images, previously product images, everybody would have to request it from the art department. This last month, it's now become automated. So now we're training sales and all of the sales support how to do it. And their response is, we've been waiting for you. You know, like, oh my gosh, where was this? So I think it's a very positive experience for us. And most of the distribution that we're doing is self-service between our product images, between doing that. Some of it's being pushed out. It's very minimal. You know, I don't have a TV channel or a type of thing that I'm pushing content from that perspective, but we're still publishing content. I mean, I've got over 16,000 downloads a month, which is pretty unreal for, you know, we sell soda water.
Yeah, I mean, for distribution for Amazon Studios is a multifaceted thing. I mean, we tend to view our vendors as our customer as well. So, you know, the people that we work with on our content, you know, we'll talk to them, and it is, to a certain degree, dealer's choice in that area. But we try and be as flexible as we can. We obviously use standard tools like, you know, Aspera or Signiant or whatever it might be. But we try and keep things cloud native as well. So, like, we use Amazon S3 quite a bit for a lot of our stuff, and our distribution is no different. And our main distribution kind of endpoint is obviously Amazon Video. And we obviously, you know, work very closely with them and use native Amazon tools to kind of make that happen too.
So you have all these tools, and you have your digital asset management system at the hub of that. How do you future-proof some of this? Matt, you were mentioning using all this legacy technology that everyone has to deal with. They've all been burned.
Yes.
So they're dealing with maybe a new system, and they're trying to future-proof not just the technologies and tools they're using, the methodologies as well.
So that's one of the most interesting things. So Amazon Studios is here, and you know, I talked to another client in the space. You know, who do you look at? Well, we're looking at Netflix. We're looking at Amazon, because you've got studios that have moved into the space that are technology companies. and you've got older technology or older studios, content creators that have not been technology companies. But that's not really true. They started out doing custom dev, everybody in the room did, and then went through the edicts of the kind of late 2000s, mid-2000s, of let's get on standard packaged software to lower our costs. And we're sort of at the end of that run of sort of the monolithic beast of you will be trapped in this, in whatever the content ECM provider has given you. And now we're moving on to a new phase because everyone has figured out that isn't future-proof. Problem is the technology has revved so quickly in the last several years that it's been hard to make a decision of which direction you're going. And I think that mist has cleared in the last year or so. Mm-hmm. I think, after some certain things happened in the market, where Amazon came in, Netflix, it's really proven out that your data is just as safe on Amazon as it would be anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and adopt it. And then what does that mean for the overall cost of compute? And then that's where you see, we've seen some great stuff on Amazon native applications or Azure native applications where you're running services. When you start moving into that level where you're really configuring the services directly for your business and have that speed and flexibility of adapting that technology as you go, mm-hmm. then it really doesn't, at that point you are future-proofing because you're no longer hooked to the code base of potentially what a CPG company may need in their system. You're actually kind of making your own, you're some degree rolling your own, but you're doing that in frameworks, and that's a big difference, and I think that's where it needs to be. I think everybody needs to have development operations in media and entertainment. Certainly Amazon does, and certainly Netflix does, because the speed, the ability to push out the changes, the needed tools that matter in a timely fashion, that's how you're going to get there. You're not going to get there without doing some coding.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what I'd say from a kind of future-proofing perspective is don't be afraid to try stuff. Like one of the biggest kind of like things which will slow down the adoption of new technologies or future-proofing anything is fear, right? Don't be frightened of actually getting it wrong. I mean, that's easy for me to say because obviously, I've got my damn thing. But, it wasn't just like I went out and just did it. Like, we didn't just decide, we're going to go down this path. It was, we'll go down this path and see what happens. And don't be afraid to kind of like, take a left turn, and that's a big thing. If you just don't do anything, you just sit still. So future-proofing is about trying it. And then, if it's a small proof of concept or if it's just, testing the water, do it. Because if you don't do it, you're never going to know.
Right.
Do we have any questions?
We don't really have time for questions. Okay. Sorry, I'm here to say we're already over.
Thanks, guy.
But the good news is, right, you guys are all going to stick around for a drink, so we can do individual questions over beer or wine just after the next session. All right, give a big round of applause to Mary Yerkovic, great panel.